It's not often we take note of these intersections between social and fiscal policy. That is a particular interest of mine, and to draw that to your attention. And it's with this in mind that I will segue into my introduction of Dr. Brian Lee Crowley, because in his book, Fearful Symmetry, The Fall and Rise of Canada's Founding Values, he does draw attention to this in a brilliant chapter about the family. And in this chapter on the family and how family contributed to the building of a great Canadian nation, he discusses the work ethic that is first learned in families, the benefits of marriage for both men and women, also an underreported story today, and the idea that where the family suffers, so too do our communities and the economy at large. And so I was very pleased to read that chapter and found it to be very compelling. It may be a sort of story angle that is less, it may be counterintuitive to the public at large, but we're very pleased when someone as thoughtful and well-spoken as Brian takes up the banner, so to speak. So I'll put in the plug for Brian so that he doesn't have to. His book is for sale outside today, and you can purchase that, and I highly recommend that you do. Brian is also currently launching a new think tank in Ottawa, the MacDonald Laurier Institute. So we're pleased to welcome another group on the scene here, though Brian is, of course, no stranger to Ottawa. He was the Clifford Clark Visiting Economist with the Federal Department of Finance from 2006 to 2008. He's also the founder of the Atlantic Institute for Market Studies, a Halifax-based public policy think tank. He has a PhD in political economy from the London School of Economics, and if I were to go on with his accomplishments and credentials, we'd be here all day. So please join me in welcoming Brian Lee Crowley.
Just turned on my wireless mic, but I, being a technophobe, I'm never sure whether these things actually work. I'm not going to repeat the mistake I saw somebody make at an all candidates meeting I attended recently at in another province, which shall go nameless, where there was, I'm sure you've all been to these things. So there was the candidates up at the front of the room, and all of a sudden the PA system went dead. And one of the candidates, particularly leather-lunged variety of the species, so often on display at the question period, said, "Well, that's no problem. You can all hear me in the back, can't you?" This little voice drifted up from the back. "No." Somebody in the front stood up and said, "Can I change places with you?" So I'm not going to ask if you can hear me, but if you have any difficulty, please just raise your hand and I'll try and speak up. I'm going to start by reading to you a little extract from one of my favorite authors, someone named Theodore Dalrymple, some of you may be familiar with. His real name actually is Tony Daniels. Theodore Dalrymple is a nom de plume. Many people I know are disappointed that he has such a prosaic name, but anyway. He wrote a wonderful book called Our Culture, What's Left of It. And this is what he had to say. There has been an unholy alliance between those on the left who believe that man is endowed with rights but no duties, and libertarians on the right who believe that consumer choice is the answer to all questions, an idea eagerly adopted by the left in precisely those areas where it does not apply. Thus, people have a right to bring forth children any way they like. And the children, of course, have the right not to be deprived of anything, at least anything material. How men and women associate and have children is merely a matter of consumer choice, of no more moral consequence than the choice between dark chocolate and milk chocolate. And the state must not discriminate amongst different forms of association and child-rearing, even if such non-discrimination has the same effect as French and British neutrality, during the Spanish Civil War. Now, for those of you who don't know what that means British and French neutrality meant the fascists won the Spanish Civil War. The consequences to the children and to society do not enter into the matter. For in any case, it is the function of the state to ameliorate, by redistributive taxation, the material effects of individual irresponsibility, and to ameliorate the emotional, educational, and spiritual effects by an army of social workers, psychologists, educators, counselors, and the like, who have themselves come to form a powerful vested interest of dependence on the government. Now, I could stop there, because that's pretty much everything I wanted to say to you, but I actually have, the rest of my talk is a gloss on Theodore Dalrymple's talk, and I'm just going to give you another very quick quotation, which I think is wonderful along the same lines. Self-discipline, a sense of justice, honesty, fairness, chivalry, moderation, public spirit, respect for human dignity, firm ethical norms. All of these things are things people must possess before they go to the market and compete with each other. These are indispensable supports which preserve both market and competition from degeneration. Family, church, genuine communities, and tradition are their sources. And that's from William Robke in a book entitled A Humane Economy. Now, Andrew very kindly mentioned my book. Some of you may have had a chance to leaf through it. If so, you'll know that it is a celebration of some fundamental values that I think informed the first century of Canada's existence and extended well past the founding of Canada into the past prior to Confederation. As the book recounts, for some reasons, we don't need to worry about it too much right now, Canada lost sight of a great deal of that endowment of values over the last half century, in part because we understood poorly why those values were important. We thought we could toss them aside because they were inconvenient, because we came to believe in the absolute value of liberation from the past, from tradition, from constraints on our behavior and on our emotions. And these constraints came to be seen as words that some of you may remember. They resonate with my youth in the 60s and 70s. These constraints came to be seen as inauthentic, old-fashioned, as obstacles to realizing our true selves, a realization best achieved by doing whatever made us feel good at the time. Of course, the 70s could be summed up by the phrase, just do it. If we thought back to that set of ideas that characterized Canada for the first 80 or 90 years of its existence, for example, we mostly seem to take the view that the founders of our society were trying to make themselves and their fellows miserable through unrelieved Calvinist gloom, I know there will be Calvinists in the room who will come up and say, you don't really understand Calvin. He was a great guy. And I'm going to leave that debate for another time. Sometimes I think, you know, he led the high school glee club after I talked to these people. Never mind. Including a mean-spirited insistence that everyone capable of working should do so, that we should respect authority and our inherited traditions and behaviors. But I think this is completely to misunderstand what our founders thought that they were doing and what they were handing on to us, our progeny. Contrary to these modern prejudices, the founders had a theory about what makes people happy. Work and family were part of that theory. And each of these things, they believed, fulfilled the deepest needs of human beings. We are not made for sloth, but for productive work. Real work, work that confers benefits on us, on our families, and the broader society, is one of the two key ways in which fully mature adults realize their highest purpose and greatest satisfaction. The other way is by forming and nurturing a family. But our forebears also believed that to achieve this kind of fulfillment, human beings had to overcome a natural desire to avoid work, a desire to be looked after by, is that Calvin on the phone? A natural desire to avoid work a natural desire to be looked after by others and to indulge our emotions and desires at the moment. They thought that achieving a high level of self-reliance, self-respect, and self-sacrifice is part of the maturation process which distinguishes a fully developed human adult from someone who remains behindhand, thank you, Dave, in achieving their fully human stature. Babies, of course, are totally needy, totally self-centered, totally dependent beings. If they progress successfully in their development, they gradually learn that they cannot remain dependent on others, but must increasingly assume responsibility for themselves, while at the same time learning to cooperate successfully with others. And progress, of course, as anyone who has watched children grow up, progress, of course, is painful and fitful. But when children are successful in that process, under the guidance of their parents and others that we'll talk about in a minute, they take their rightful place as mature adults who have learned to overmaster their childish impulse to think that others exist to serve them. Or at least women do. Most women seem to be of the view that men haven't quite got there yet. My wife certainly thinks that. They substitute in that impulse's place a growing mastery of their capacities and abilities, deploying those capacities for the benefit of themselves and others. And this traditionally brought self-respect, reputation, honor, and livelihood from the community. So happiness for Canada's founders sprang from a learned ability to discipline untutored emotions and desires. Nature, contrary to the just-do-it mentality of the 60s and 70s, nature actually pulls us in a destructive direction. Culture, support of social institutions, and self-discipline allow us to resist that siren call. And part and parcel of this view of happiness was that we had an obligation as a society to support each other in this difficult struggle to get our selfish impulses under control. A world in which people could live too easily from the efforts of others wasn't just a world that was expensive for those who paid the bill. It was a world of temptation set before fallible people. A world that encouraged them not to strive to achieve the discipline and self-control by which human beings reach their greatest good. It is the moral equivalent of encouraging crime by leaving your wallet and laptop in an unlocked car, putting temptation in the path of the weak-willed. And that's really essentially the subject of my talk today, the extent to which human nature and traditional institutions like the family work together to produce vast benefits that are not merely private. They are not merely benefits for you and me as individuals, but they are also public benefits. And indeed, Andrea touched on some of these themes in her description of the wonderful research that she's done over the last year or so. Indeed, I will make the case in the rest of my talk that many of the things we take for granted as bedrock public benefits of Canadian society, freedom, democracy, and the rule of law, are only made possible because they float like the atmosphere of our planet on the rock-solid foundation of the Earth. The atmosphere gives us life, but without the Earth, on which that tiny sphere of life exists, there would be no life. Another way of saying this is that the public institutions we value so much are in ways that we little suspect or grasp, dependent on the character of the people who live under them. So now we come to the idea of character. And no one, in my view, can talk intelligibly or intelligently about human character without invoking the name of Aristotle. Sorry, but I actually think Aristotle was a really cool guy, even cooler than Calvin. Okay. My gloss on Aristotle is that we become what we habitually do. We become what we habitually do. It is thus to Aristotle that we owe the idea of second nature. That's an Aristotelian idea, second nature. When we do something often enough, it becomes second nature to us. It becomes an overlay on the inclinations and instincts that nature implanted in us, which are our first untutored nature, first and second nature. If we habitually lie, Aristotle tells us, taking the easy way out, acting heedlessly of consequences, considering only our own immediate advantage without any moral dimension, if we habitually lie, we will become, our character will be shaped by this, and we will become liars. That will be part of our character. If on the other hand, we habitually act courageously, we will become brave. It leaves an imprint on us. If we discipline ourselves to act honorably, eventually we simply do it unthinkingly, instinctually, as part of that acquired second nature, and we become honorable. While our first nature is simply given, that's what we come into the world with, our first nature, we can shape our second nature by essentially repeating desirable actions until they become impregnated in our mind and our soul. And the great gift that parents bestow on their children is not to indulge their first nature, but to discipline them to act in accordance with the right behaviors that create the right character, even before the children are old enough to understand why they are the right behaviors. This is a key idea. Parents must inculcate these behaviors in children before the children understand the value of the behaviors. So another name for second nature, as you will have seen by now, is character. Character. Now, family and marriage were part of the bedrock social assumptions that Canada was built on in its first 90 years, as well as in the colonial era that preceded Confederation. And just like work, they were seen as part of a full human life, without which humans were diminished, unhappy, and unfulfilled. And this is not of merely historical interest, unrelated to our present circumstances. Today, just as in 1867, the life chances, for example, of children whose parents are married and those whose parents are not are distinctly different. And the health, happiness, and economic prospects of married parents are also better. They're not only better for the children, they're better for the parents. To the point where one can now begin to make the argument that race and class and education are being overtaken by these other factors as the chief determinants, not the only determinants, but the number one determinants of who will succeed in the Canada of the future. Like work, family is a discipline at which our first nature chafes. But also like work, research is increasingly documenting the extent to which family is an institution that is indispensable to our individual and collective social and economic success. Moreover, being the place where our character and our values are chiefly formed, family is the place where we learn to master our selfish instincts and become valuable to others as prospective spouses, as employees, and as parents. It is the place where the rising generation is formed. Family thus confers benefits on both individuals and on society. Now, of course, that happy reciprocity between individual interest and collective interest comes with a price. It's not free. Family makes demands on us. We have to be obedient children, responsible parents, supportive spouses. Think about that in the context of the rather unique period of the last 40 years. Beginning in the mid-60s, the confluence of many forces began to work a change in the minds of Canadians. There was, of course, a wave of nationalist anti-Americanism unleashed by the Vietnam War, counterculture movement that emerged in the U.S. and found echoes all around the world, including in Canada. Marxism, feminism, various other isms began a long march through our academic institutions. Keynesianism, a naive faith in the ability of government officials to manage the economy, became almost universal amongst Western governments. In the 70s, a Republican president in the United States brought in price and wage controls, the ultimate expression of confidence in government superiority over markets. Increasingly, during the same time, government was being looked to solve perennial social problems. Washington in the 1960s moved against both racial discrimination through a series of civil rights acts and against poverty through the war on poverty and the Great Society. All of these factors and many more, wider access to education, the emergence of effective contraception, the growth of cities and suburbs, affected Canada as much as they did in other Western societies. And any of you who've read my book will know that I argue that over top of that series of trends that was rocking the Western world, we had some special factors in Canada. We had the largest baby boom generation in the Western world. That undermined our faith in the ability of the economy to provide work for everybody who wanted it. We also saw the rise of an aggressive separatist nationalism in Quebec, which unleashed a torrent of public spending designed to bind Quebecers to the federal state. So accompanying all those developments that I've just talked about came the growth of a diverse range of state-funded ways in which one could get by in the world without really working. Many of you are perhaps old enough to remember when, just to pick one example, Bryce Mackesy and his colleagues liberalized unemployment insurance in 1971 and overnight created the UIC ski team, which many of my friends won gold medals at. So in some vulnerable parts of the population, family lost its power as the last refuge in times of trouble. The need for the disciplined family unit to socialize the rising generation having declined, it became harder and harder to justify the legal, social, and institutional supports that buttressed marriage and encouraged couples to stay together even when times were hard. Politicians and other opinion leaders began to do what Daniel Patrick Moynihan famously called defining deviance down. Or to put it a different way, because deviance is something that offends a lot of people, I call it defining selfish behavior down, in the sense of offering people with a guilty conscience the political cover to escape the obligations of family when those obligations became inconvenient or too burdensome. Not only was it made remarkably easy to dissolve the marriage bond, but the state stepped up to the plate to help cover the cost of the damage, at least in the short run. Just as it made it easier than it had ever been to choose not to work, it also made it easier than it had ever been to choose not to have a family or to choose to leave it once it had been started. Program after program was conceived to pick up the pieces of family breakdown, whether in support for lone mothers and their children, or income support for the elderly, or child care for parents who could not afford to stay home with their children, no matter how much they wished to do so. And in its headlong rush to finance the social costs of what had traditionally been seen to be antisocial behavior, the state pushed up the tax burden on those who were married and working, and made a major contribution to the demographic bust.